May it please the court. My name is Dana Weiss, registration number 36656, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Bertrand. I'd like to touch upon arguments 1 through 3 of the opening brief and focus on those if we have time, because all of those are interrelated actually to one extent or another, based on the context of this case. It's a fundamental principle of criminal law, as protected by both the United States and the Colorado Constitutions, Rule 7 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure in Colorado, as well as a long line of cases supporting the same, that no person shall be held to answer for crimes that are not set forth in the indictment or the information. Also, principles of due process protect a criminally accused's right to notice of the charges against him, and the evidence and the facts that support those charges, as well as the defendant's right to present a defense. Few, if any, situations or circumstances could be more unfair and prejudicial than when a defendant is charged with one offense but then surprised at trial by the introduction of evidence and argument establishing an entirely different offense for which he had no notice and he's not prepared to defend against. And that's what happened to Mr. Bertrand in this case. He was informed both by the charging document as well as the prosecutor's articulated election in this case. The state was proceeding on the basis that KB was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct based solely on her developmental disability. In fact, the pretrial discovery in this case established that this was the basis of the charges as well. The prosecutor was asked twice in this case whether developmental disability was the basis of the charges, and he affirmed that it was. So Mr. Bertrand came to trial prepared to defend against these charges, these allegations, with evidence that KB was sexually active prior to his relationship with her, that KB had contracted an STD prior from a prior partner, that KB had discussed family planning with her doctor, that KB's doctor had discussed contraceptive options with KB, and that KB, in fact, at the time of trial, was engaged to be married to another man. All of this evidence belied any allegation that KB was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct. Just because KB had a developmental disability did not mean that she was incapable of making her own life choices regarding her body, sex, or even marriage. And it would be very presumptuous to conclude that she was not able to make those decisions about her life or lead a fulfilling life otherwise, including the right to enter into relationships based on the fact that she was developmentally delayed.
Wasn't that a jury question, with all respect, counsel?
Yes, it was, and I agree that it was a jury question, but it did not necessarily mean that she was incapable of appraising. It was a very factually intense question that the jury should have been submitted. However, that's why we came to trial prepared to defend against those charges based on the fact that she had been making those life choices in the past.
Was that evidence admitted?
It was.
And the defendant was permitted to argue. All this, the litany you just gave us,
Yes. Shows
that she was capable of appraising the nature of her conduct.
Correct, despite her developmental disability. Yes, and there's no law that says a developmental disability per se makes somebody incapable of appraising the nature of their conduct or agreeing to have sex with other individuals.
No, and I don't believe that the people argued it that way. It's my recollection of the record. But couldn't the jury have concluded that a developmental disability in this instance made her unable to appraise the nature of her conduct?
They could have. Going into trial, that is what we anticipated defending against, and that's why we had this evidence ready to defend against the charge that KB, in this circumstance, was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct, because the evidence showed that she actually was making those decisions all along and was proven to be capable by virtue of the fact that she's engaging in these family planning discussions with her doctor and these prior sexual partners, and was engaged in marriage at the time of trial.
Well, let me flag for you then my concern about the argument that you've raised in the brief. You've indicated that you think this was some type of a variance, either a constructive amendment or perhaps a simple variance, to subsection H. Now, the mere fact that the same facts could have established a subsection H offense doesn't necessarily mean that it was amended to a subsection H offense. Can you respond to that, please?
Yes, and I think that what I've touched on so far is what we had noticed of and we were prepared to defend against. The problem where the constructive variance comes in is that once we announced we were intending to introduce all of this evidence, the prosecutor realized the inherent problem in their case based on this evidence, and for the first time changed its election and the articulated basis for the charges in this case from the developmental disability rendering her incapable to the fact that she was taking medications that made her asleep or sleepy.
All right, so in my legal research, I haven't run into a case where it's just some additional evidence that would help establish the already charged subsection, mm-hmm. why you add some additional evidence as long as you have notice of it, which you did have notice of the medications. Why that could be considered a variance. I haven't seen any cases where that's considered a variance.
And, well, first of all, what they did elect, and we did, let me address this in turn, but first of all, they did elect based on the developmental disability. And I think that the trial counsel below had identified the problem or that, they were receiving this discovery about medications and wondering why this was, and so they wanted an election based on the fact that they were seeking additional information, and they had understood the basis of the charges to be the developmental disability. And that's why we sought the election. Once the prosecutor committed to that and articulated that this was the basis, it then implicates my client's rights, constitutionally protected rights to notice and due process, to then base the charges on an entirely different set of evidence. And I would point to the cases that I discussed in the opening brief, which included the Sterone case, that's the U.S. Supreme Court case from 1960, as well as People v. Simmons and People v. Rice. And inherent in those cases is the jury unanimity problem when you have a variance. So you have evidence that's supposed to be relied upon as the basis of charges, and that evidence changes. That constitutes a prejudicial variance.
But Ms. Weiss, didn't Judge Iupa say that the evidence of the medications that the victim was taking were interrelated with her developmental disability?
That is correct, and that's also what's interesting procedurally about this case is that ultimately the trial court ruled that evidence of the medications could be admitted so long as they were related or taken as the result of her developmental disability, because that was what everybody had noticed was the basis of the charges. However, that then became the basis to establish that really what was the issue here, according to the prosecutor, was that she was sleeping as a result, or sleepy, groggy, as a result of taking medications, and therefore she was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct because she was sleeping. And that's the heart of the constructive amendment in this case, is that the prosecutor then relied upon this certain separate set of facts that she was sleeping and therefore incapable as the basis of these charges.
But not the sole basis, counsel. It also relied heavily on the developmental disability in the closing argument, as she couldn't appraise. So why couldn't the jury have just decided that subsection B was applicable based on her developmental disability?
Well,
that evidence alone.
It could have, but again, with the prejudicial variance, and in this case, if you look to Rice and Simmons, the problem with the prejudicial variance is that it raises problems of unanimity. So some of the jurors could have decided it was based on the inherent fact of the developmental disability, while other jurors could have based their decision or their conviction on the fact that she was groggy or sleepy. And it's extremely problematic in this case because the prosecutor, as it's raised in argument two of my argument, the prosecutor convinced the trial court to give an instruction with no basis in the law that a person is incapable of appraising the nature of their conduct if they are partially asleep.
The prosecutor argued that.
Argued, and then the judge gave instruction. Instruction number 16 is a directed verdict telling the jury that if they found that she was partially asleep, whatever that means, that they were to find that she was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct. And that then told the jury that the prosecutor had satisfied that that element.
But not unless it found she was partially asleep. That's not a directed verdict.
Correct. If they believed that she thought that she was partially asleep, that then required them to make the legal conclusion that she was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct.
Now, to the extent you have a problem with that, isn't that exactly what the Colorado Supreme Court said?
No, actually, the Colorado Supreme Court in the Platt decision said that, and that was a sufficiency of the evidence case, and it basically said that the trial court or the prosecutor in that case, where the facts were not disputed, they were not expanded, the basis of the charges were not expanded, there was one set of facts, and that was that the victim in that case had woken up to having sex with somebody, having not consented, having not known this person, but believing it was her boyfriend.
Well, I recognize it was a sufficiency of the evidence case, but Justice Ives' language basically says if you're partially asleep, you can't appraise the nature of your conduct.
And I would argue that she doesn't say quite that. What she says is that the evidence was sufficient because the jury may have concluded, and she uses that word, she doesn't direct, that does indeed satisfy that element because it is a question of fact for the jury, and that's the critical difference here. But she states,
should be Justice Ives you're talking
yes,
about?
I'm sorry. Justice Ives states in offering that opinion that the evidence that a victim is partially asleep may support a jury finding that as a result they were incapable of appraising. It does not establish a rule that they are indeed incapable of establishing. That is a question of fact for the jury. And that's the problem with the directed verdict in this case, or in my directed verdict argument, that they were instructed they had to make that finding. The other problem with that, and I'll hit on this briefly before I sit down and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, but is that in Platt they also said that the defendant was not entitled to a consent defense because by making that finding, they were then necessarily rejecting any potential consent defense. The judge in my case removed that element from the jury's consideration by telling them, if you find that the victim was partially asleep, you have to find that she was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct, and therefore that element is satisfied. The jury then inherent, or by virtue of that instruction 16, did not make a finding whether consent was applicable even in this case.
Well, and so consent's not a defense under B2.
That's correct. That is correct. And I think Platt, it gets a little convoluted by Platt's...
I want to clarify your position. In jury instruction 16, the first sentence states, a person is incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct when she is asleep or partially asleep during assault. And your issue, I take it, with that instruction is the use of the word is.
Correct.
Had it said may be incapable because of, then you would not have had the same issue. You're saying Platt says the jury has to decide if the victim was incapable, but they can't be instructed that the victim was incapable.
And it doesn't go so far to state that, because that wasn't the issue in Platt, but the language in Platt is that a finding that a victim is partially asleep may support a jury's determination that she's therefore incapable of appraising.
The language in Platt says the relevant question before the jury is whether the victim was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct.
For the jury, yes.
And you're saying the court took it away from the defendant because he said she is incapable if she is asleep.
Precisely.
I know they have to find she's asleep. That's the next part. Okay.
If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Weiss. You have 1 minute and 27 seconds left.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jay Fisher. I represent the people in this matter, registration number 44350. At the outset of my argument, I think there's a few facts that need to be stated on the record here. First of all, is that the jury was never advised of 4021H, that the victim was physically helpless in this matter. That just never came up as an issue during the defendant's trial. Second of all, the prosecution never changed the charges throughout this entire case. It was originally charged under 4021B. stay that way through trial and went all the way to jury verdict under 4021B. The defendant was advised at the election that the charges never changed. They were advised specifically that the prosecution was proceeding under 4021B. It appears that what the defendant was trying to do was limit how the prosecution could prove that the defendant violated 4021B by trying to box them into developmental disabilities. However, they never filed a bill of particulars in this particular case, and thus the state was allowed to use whatever evidence was relevant and admissible and provided to the defense in a timely fashion to prove, in fact, that the defendant had violated 4021B. Furthermore, there's the argument that you cannot separate the victim's medications from her developmental disabilities. There was testimony on the record that the victim in this case had lifelong problems, that she was taking medication since the age of 2 or 3, and that many of these medications, in fact, made her sleepy. There's testimony regarding her medications for seizures and tremors, anxiety, the fact that she even had a sleep disorder, and that she had been taking these medications for a long, long time. They were part of her disabilities, and they, in fact, made her sleepy.
Mr. Fisher, did the evidence show that all of the medications that the victim was taking were because of her developmental disabilities, or just some of them?
I believe it was some of them, Your Honor, but the ones that were key and important to the prosecution's case, again, were for the seizures, the tremors, the anxiety, there was medication for schizophrenia.
So were all of those attributable to her developmental disability according to the evidence that was presented?
Yes, they were, Your Honor. And furthermore, there's even the argument here that, in fact, if this court were to find any kind of issue with the way this matter proceeded to trial, there's no way that the defendant's particular case could show prejudice under the facts of the case. As I've already stated, the defendant was provided the medication evidence well in advance of trial. They were put on notice of it. In fact, when they complained about the medication evidence, the trial judge was particularly a matter offered the continuance. The defendant said, I may want to get an expert about this. And the court said, if you want a continuance, you have it. They rejected that. If this court were to look at the transcripts of this particular matter, the defendant was prepared to cross-examine the prosecution's witnesses regarding the medication. That would be the victim's mother, the treating physician. And they argued in closing, in fact, that the medications didn't have the effect of making the victim unable to appraise the nature of her conduct. They said that she was awake, that she consented to the contact, and she gave the defendant permission to, in fact, wake her up and engage in sex. Now, as to the issue of the jury instruction 16, which the defendant has claimed was a directed verdict, it wasn't a directed verdict. As I said before, regarding the charges, the prosecution had to prove that the defendant violated 4021B, that the victim was incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct. That was the key issue at trial. Thus, they still had to prove their case, and one of the ways they chose to prove their case was with evidence that the victim was asleep or partially asleep.
Okay, but your learned opponent has pointed out that the opinion in Platt versus People, the Supreme Court opinion, says a sleeping victim may be incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct. And the instruction itself says a person is incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct when she's asleep or partially asleep. Isn't that an error in the instruction?
No, Your Honor, and there's a part of this instruction that everyone's ignoring. The way the instruction was worded at trial is a person is incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct when she is asleep or partially asleep during an assault. Everyone's ignoring the during an assault language in this particular issue. Now the problem is that it would direct the jury to first determine whether an assault occurred. Well, there was only one way an assault was charged in this particular matter, and that was a sexual assault. That demands that the jury go back to instruction number 15, which is to define a sexual assault under 4021B, the victim being incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct. So they had to determine that first.
I'm not following you, Mr. Fisher. Suppose a person is partially asleep. Doesn't the Platt case suggest, and I don't think it addresses this issue specifically, but doesn't it suggest that if a victim is partially asleep, that either the person may appreciate the kind that he or she is being assaulted or may not, depending on the circumstances?
It may depend on the circumstances, but again, if we're looking at a specific charge, though, again, you have to look at the charge and its whole language and all the instructions, in fact, given to the jury in this matter. And I don't think this court can ignore that particular phrase there, during an assault.
But I don't understand what bearing that phrase, during an assault, has on the specific language mentioned by Judge Terry in her question, because the instruction, as you know, said a person is incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct when she is asleep or partially asleep.
And if I'm understanding your question correctly, Your Honor, first of all, regarding the Plant decision, I think you also can't ignore the issue of consent here within what Plant said as well when considering this particular instruction. Because if consent's taken out of it, then a person cannot, in fact, appraise the nature of their conduct. In other words, if you look at the language of appraising the nature of their conduct, that implies decision-making, awareness, the person being actually somewhat conscious and sentient about what's happening around him or her. But the thing is that if you say that consent is not an issue under 402.1b, and that removes that particular issue, well, then they can't consent. And thus, in fact, if a person is asleep or partially asleep, then they cannot appraise the nature of their conduct.
So are you saying then if a person is partially asleep, that person can never appraise the nature of her conduct?
At least under the facts of this case, yes, Your Honor. Absolutely.
Are you saying Platt says that as well?
I'm not saying that Platt says that necessarily, but we have this particular issue with the language and the whole issue of consent. That's the problem. Because if they say that consent is not an issue, then a person can't necessarily make the appropriate decisions about whether they're appraising the nature of their conduct if they're asleep or partially asleep. But again, I need to steer the court back to the whole issue of this language of during an assault. Because, as I said before, that directs the jury to determine whether an assault occurred in the first place, whether it even has to weigh jury instruction number 16.
Well, I recognize that your focus on the phrase during an assault. I mean, that is the question before the jurors to determine, or that was one of the questions, to determine whether an assault had occurred. But it seems to me that it's relevant to that whether or not the person was, whether or not the court's instruction required the jury to determine that the victim couldn't appraise the nature of her conduct if the jury believed that she was partially asleep.
And Your Honor, again, looking at it strictly under the facts of this particular case, is that you had a victim, in fact, who was partially asleep, who testified that she was groggy, she was not consenting to her conduct, and the fact that she suffered from developmental disabilities, in fact, is, you know, under the evidence of this particular case, that she could not consent. And so, ultimately, the instruction was a correct recitation of the law based upon the stream or the line of cases, the two Platt decisions.
Is there specific language in Platt that supports what you just said?
Your Honor, I have to concede that Platt does say may. Absolutely, it does. But then again, like I said before, you can't ignore this language, this added clause in there during an assault. If it had just said a person is incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct when she is asleep or partially asleep, we think we have a much bigger problem here. But it doesn't. It still has this added clause on the end of during an assault.
Well, I'm having trouble understanding why your argument isn't circular. Because if the jury determines that it has to look at whether this section, this instruction is met before, doesn't have to do that before determining whether there was an assault?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because
this instruction is the one that takes consent out of the picture, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. We would agree with that.
All right. And so if the jury is hung up on consent, which they ordinarily would be, in determining whether there was an assault, isn't this the precursor that they would have to look at to determine, okay, well, I see that this is applicable, so I'm going to determine that there was an assault and the guy's guilty.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree with that interpretation, because if you look at the entire construction of it, it says a person capable of appraising the nature of her conduct when she is asleep or partially asleep during an assault. Well, then they have to determine whether an assault in fact occurred. And if they have to determine an assault occurred, they have to look within the jury charges to see where assault is defined. As I said before, it's only one place where assault is defined in the jury charges. That's instruction 15, sexual assault, 4021B. A person is incapable of appraising the nature of his or her conduct. That's what they have to deliberate first. Once they made that determination, then they can go back and consider instruction number 16.
Why would they need the first sentence then if they've already decided it? I'm not following your... I haven't really looked at instruction 15. If they've already decided that she's incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct during an assault, they don't need the first sentence.
Well, to be honest with Your Honor, when I was weighing these instructions as well, it was a little perplexing to me too, because if they determined it was an assault, then this almost makes the instruction itself a nullity.
Is instruction 16, I think it's not a pattern instruction?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It was derived from case law.
In the grant of cert in Platt, the question was whether a sleeping victim is incapable of appraising the nature of her conduct. That was a grant of cert question. And they said, yes, you'd be okay. But when they write the opinion, Judge Ike changed her phraseology. He said the grant of cert was on whether a sleeping victim may be capable or can be capable. So even Justice Sides, in her own opinion, seems to recognize that the issue of is can't be decided.
I understand, Your Honor, and I'll be perfectly honest, this is not the cleanest instruction I've ever seen. But at the same time, looking at the way that it's positioned in this case, what the jury has to determine first, and the assumption that the jury follows the instructions, and according to at least the people's interpretation of this, they need to determine whether an assault occurred first, which kicks them back again to instruction 15.
Defendant objected to this instruction. We're not on plain error, we're on harmless error.
I agree with that, yes. As the defendant argued, the first two issues within their brief, if there are any further questions, then the people would ask this court affirm the conviction below.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
Thank you.
I wanted to touch on a couple of points. And first, I did want to reaffirm, it's correct, it was not a pattern instruction. This instruction was based on the Platt decision. But I would just point to People v. Zukowski, which is cited in my brief, and that holds for the proposition that, in fact, I'll quote it, in preparing jury instructions, the trial court should generally abstain from giving abstract statements of law or taking language out of context from cases or unrelated statutes. In this case, we did acknowledge, and we recognized the trial court, or counsel below did, that was not a correct statement of the law, and we did object, as Judge Richman asked earlier. I did also
want to... Did they urge that the word be changed from is to may?
I don't think they got into the minutia.
I don't know if that's minutia. It's kind of central.
I think we were objecting to the instruction at all, because it's not a pattern jury instruction. It was based on a very particular interpretation of the Platt decision.
Would you agree that if it had said maybe instead of is, that it would have been okay to give to the jury?
I think that that's an interesting question. I don't think that I can say quite that. I think it would certainly be more in line with Platt. However, I would just note that, again, it's the trial courts instructing or going out and outside and beyond the pattern jury instructions that sometimes create these problems because they don't accurately state the law, and they can ultimately require the jury to make a finding that normally is left to the jury. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Rice. Thank you again, Mr. Fisher. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.